This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, remind us, please, what happened in the last big recession so that we don't make the same mistakes this time?
Well, it happens almost in every big sell-off, which is in the moment we cannot remember the past. I understand that. That's called recency bias in the behavioral economics world. It means that whatever happens most recently informs what you want to do next. So remember in, let's call it March of 2020 into April, you know, there was a lot of anxiety and markets cratered. The S&P 500 lost a third of its value in 5 weeks from late February right till the end of March. Nobody felt comfortable in that moment saying, oh, okay, like things will get better, because we didn't know whether they would. Uncertainty. And then, of course, things got better and markets roared higher. I mean, shockingly, frankly, when you think about it, because, you know, if you look at the last 3 years, it's been phenomenal. We have seen in 2019, 2020, 2021, the index is up, let's call it almost 90%. And now this year, it's down. And we see the stock market is down. The bond index is down. The only thing up is commodities, basically. But I think that in the moment, it is good to remember that all these times where you're despairing is usually the time where you should probably just not do much. It's like the old saying, don't just sit there, do something. Let's flip that on its head. Let's say, don't do something, just sit there.
Just sit there. Price gouging is seems to be all the rage now. What can the government do about price gouging? First of all, what is price gouging? And what's our history of the government actually doing anything about it?
Well, price gouging is what it sounds like, which is there's an opportunistic seller who uses something real that's happening in the economy as a means to just jam prices higher for consumers. So obviously, you might look at the gas pump, although that's a very public way to gouge. It's sometimes more, I think it's sometimes a little bit more worrisome when it's happening in the food area. But, you know, the government doesn't have a very good track record of figuring it out. It doesn't usually happen that often. We talk about it, but it doesn't usually happen that often. So, which is why the government isn't very effective in policing it. So, I mean, listen, if you look at gas prices, I know you guys have terribly high gas prices. We're hitting new highs. You know, we're up $1.50 from a year ago nationally about. That's a lot. And food prices are higher and rents are rising. All these things are happening. Some of it feels like gouging, you know, but if you look at it from the other side, like I was talking to a landlord over the weekend and she said, you know, like my renters, I had to basically drop the rent during the pandemic to keep people in. And now they're calling me a price gouger. They're calling me nasty names online. She's like, I didn't make any money for 2 years.
Yeah.
Zero money, you know, when I had to finance these apartments. And so now I'm raising my rents. And it may seem like 20% is a lot. But if you look back 3 years ago, it's not a lot.
I'm just trying to figure out whether I should post snarky tweets about people who are always celebrating the free market. But when it actually kicks in, they hate it.
Oh, well, there's that. I think that let me just say this about that. I think posting snark is usually it's fun in the moment and it's not a good payoff. It's like sending a nasty gram to somebody. And, you know, you maybe just keep it in your draft file.
So
I shouldn't
do it. OK,
I think not.
That's good advice. Here's something else. I got an invitation from our stock advisor, you know, who we work with, inviting us to a really fancy dinner. This is the first time that's ever happened. Should I be worried?
Is it just dinner for the, like, you and your spouse person?
It's a
client appreciation?
It's a client appreciation dinner, yes.
You know what? I mean, it's not, you shouldn't be worried. I mean, I think it's funny that they do that, you know, when the market's crapping out. I'm not a huge fan of the dinner. I'll tell you what I'm a fan of. As somebody who was in that business for a long time, I always liked, instead, to give my clients something of value that's not a golf outing or a dinner or tickets. I would say, like, having a great speaker available or a service available. I remember one year that somebody suggested, well, you know, I really need help with college planning. And we had somebody just come and be available and speak to our clients about the best way to approach, you know, high school years with your kid when you're thinking about college. And it wasn't about paying for college. It was about the idea of, like, how to pick the right school for you. It was just so well attended, and it was probably the best feedback I ever got for a client event. Just, in other words, something of value that's more part of your overall financial life. There are times where I know a lot of advisors, like when there's a big change in the tax law, you have a really interesting speaker who comes in. If there's a change maybe in the rules around debt for college students, maybe that's going to be something. I don't know, dinner? I'd rather go to dinner with my friends, not my advisor.
So this too shall pass, I think, is the message of yours.
I think so. I mean, I mean, there's a part of this that is just plain old euphoria, right? I mean, and euphoria and bubbles, they do burst. So, you know, it's not worth saying to somebody who owns crypto, see, I told you so. That's a terrible thing to say. You sound very old, okay, boomerish.
Even I would never say that. That's right. That's just piling on.
It is, and it's not worth it. And you know what, when you were saying, I think it's funny when people believe in the free market. It's the funny thing, like when people are investing and they tell you how much money they have in the stock market at the end of last year, and you say, wow, that's a lot, you know, that's dangerous, and they kind of roll their eyes. Well, yeah, I'm a wimp. I love being wimpy. I could have made much more money in my investments had I been less wimpy, but I would never have been able to take it. You really have to know yourself as an investor, you know? And I would rather work longer than take on more risk. By the way, you know the greatest way to save your retirement account that's going down in value?
Yeah, what?
Keep working.
That's right. Keep the money coming in.
It's a tight labor market. Don't be foolish.
CBS's Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
By the way, we are getting close to $6 gas, as in $5.99 at the Shell station in South Seattle, the 76 station in SeaTac, the Shell station in Central Seattle, Tukwila. So if anybody actually pays $6, you should text us at 888-973-5476.
I mean, you kind of have to when you work and you have to come into the office. There's no way to avoid it.
Yeah. First time I've seen it. I don't think we've ever had $6 gas.
I've never seen it.
On Mondays, we bring in Hannah Scott to give us the latest edition of Crime and Punishment. And we do it because we report on these stories all the time. We report on crime all the time. But very rarely do we get to follow up and see maybe why there is so much crime. Are people who commit these crimes being put away? And so Hannah's job is to tell us. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. And the answer is yes, at least in some cases, as was the case on Friday when there were, again, multiple sentencings in King County courts. Our first case involves a repeat assaulter. His name's Don Porter.
He was on his way to Swedish Hospital when the AMR ambulance staff, were harassed with some really terrible derogatory terms. That wasn't the assault, but he spit all over one of the ambulance workers. And this was right, you know, during a peak of the pandemic, during one of the waves in December 2020. This is a guy with a history of, you know, pretty significant crimes, five previous assaults, multiple theft convictions.
Now, and this Casey McNerthy, by the way, with the King County Prosecutor's Office, and he says these types of cases, these types of assaults, are more common than you might think.
An interesting note on this is that, you know, these cases don't make the news often other than this segment, but, you know, in 2020, there were 302 cases that were charged of assault in the third degree, and those are assaults on police officers and firefighters and ambulance staff and bus drivers and hospital staff. And I'd say that it's at least 302 cases that year, because if there's someone who's attacked and like the metro driver or an officer or a firefighter has a broken bone, that's a higher assault charge. And so it's at least 302. And so far this year, we've charged 90 of those cases.
So 90 this year and then 302 the year prior. So it's very common for those types. And this guy, repeat offender, got sentenced to 22 months. Casey says this next crime involves a drug-addicted parents who put a toddler in danger.
German Vasquez, who is He was convicted for a drug crime for having meth around a three-year-old child. This started in January of 2020 when he and his then-girlfriend were arguing, and they pulled over near I-90 and State Route 900. When troopers found them, he was running after the vehicle that she was driving away. The conditions in the vehicle were just terrible. What was written in the investigation documents was that there was utter disregard for this three-year-old who was found hungry with a wet diaper and had a bag of meth right next to her.
And the details in the court documents get much more in depth. They're very, very, very bad.
And this was an argument taking place right out in the open along I-90.
Yeah, with the Issaquah. Girlfriend, the mom driving away in the car and the boyfriend chasing and the little three-year-old sitting there with the giant bag of meth next to her. It was just crazy. So when it comes to sentencing on these types of cases, you'd be surprised.
This former boyfriend who was sentenced on Friday, when he was arrested, he had multiple warrants for felony crimes. What's interesting is even when you have a bag of meth around a young child like this, the statewide sentencing range that's set by lawmakers is surprisingly low. If you're somebody, for example, who doesn't have a criminal history, and you were convicted of this, of having meth around a three-year-old, the statewide range for what you would spend in jail is 3 to 9 months.
Huh. But so 3 to 9 months for a giant bag of meth around the baby. That didn't happen in this case, though, because as you heard, this guy had a lot of warrants out.
In this case, the person who was sentenced on Friday, he had an offender score of 17. So he received nearly 4 years for this crime. The mother also, who was 6 months pregnant at the time that she was stopped, she ended up being involuntarily committed. And she later pleaded guilty to endangerment with a controlled substance. She was ordered to have a substance abuse and alcohol evaluation.
Was ordered to have that. And the last public record on that, which was in October of last year, she completed that successfully and was doing much better. So the guy got years behind bars and the mother is doing better. The child, I believe, is still being raised.
Let me ask you, if we were to legalize all drugs, which I realize is radical, but some people call for it.
There's an effort for it.
You're right. That would mean that neither of these people would have been arrested. Is that correct? Because there'd be no, I mean...
No, that's not correct. That is not correct. And I'll actually explain some of that to you. Because this is a child endangerment charge with this particular situation. So because right now possession, simple possession, is also just a misdemeanor, right? And it's a mandatory diversion on the first two because of the Blake decision and the so-called Blake fix that's in effect until next year at least. So basically in this case, because of the amount of meth that can go up to beyond possession, and because this child was in danger, that's a separate charge, and that would be the case. So same, like even under Blake, if it's a larger amount of drugs where they can get you for dealing, let's say, then that's going to be charged, and that would be the case even if you decriminalized, I believe, is the idea. And and that's, again, currently what's going on with Blake. So
okay. So the presence of a child changes things.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's still very dangerous, obviously, for a kid to be around something like that. I want to get to our last case. This was a biggie. The final case ends with a man behind a bizarre murder getting over 40 years on Friday.
This particular case was especially kind of chilling in a lot of ways because it was seemingly so random. There was no relationship between our defendant and the victim. The victim did not know this person at all and had really had very little interaction with him whatsoever other than one kind of preliminary effort by the defendant to learn more about the victim.
That's Senior Deputy King County Prosecuting Attorney David Siever talking about the Jeremy Shaw and Stephen Morfus case. Stephen Morfus was a homeowner who was murdered. And more on that random encounter. This is super creepy.
A few weeks before the victim was killed, the defendant went to the victim's home, just walked up to the front door and said he was going door to door collecting signatures for a petition that he explained to the victim had something to do with a veterans initiative. It's not the kind of neighborhood where any pedestrian would go door to door from house to house, which made the victim a little bit suspicious. But the victim did sign this petition. When the police executed the warrant at the defendant's house after the victim had been killed, they found that petition in the victim's home office.
Wow.
So he had a copy of the signature, which he attempted to mimic on a deed.
Because the motive here, this is about taken this man's house?
The victim was just a homeowner who had a house that the defendant decided he wanted. And so he just kind of scouted the property as well as a few other places, chose this one, and then just brutally murdered this elderly man for the seemingly sole purpose of taking his house from him. I think he planned on disposing of the victim's body and then moving into the house and thinking somehow he could get away with something like that.
So he had done his research, he had researched properties, researched a law where you can go and be there and physically be in the house and then gain control of that and own it. He made this whole plot. He knocked on this guy's door. When the guy opened the door, he hit him in the head like 5 times and then cut his throat, put him in a tarp in the backyard in a shallow grave. And first in the shed, but it dug a grave. A contractor happened by like 2 days later, found the body in the shed and then called police. They tracked this guy and his wife down to Tacoma. The wife was sentenced to 4 years. She was more of a kind of an accessory after the fact. This guy got sentenced to more than 40 years on Friday. The judge saying when defense attorneys asked for the lower term of like 30 some odd years in the hopes of him having a life when he might get out, you know, he can rehabilitate, this, that, and the other. And this guy's got a criminal record that goes back to 96. He's been given a lot of chances, treatment, all of those diversionary things. And the judge said, no, absolutely not. And he gave him the high end over 40.
All right. So he's gone, isn't he?
He's gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. It's an act of love that lives on. Here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
For many, it's a mystery that blooms anew every spring.
How many years has this been here?
I don't know. A long time, though.
Daffodils. Far too many to be growing by chance. Far too beautiful to not stop and stroll. Seems randomly set along a narrow two-lane road in southwestern Connecticut.
When I drive by, it just brings tears to my eyes. Because that's how I remember them.
To Patty Pavlik, this field is no mystery. Her aunt and uncle, Bud and Florence McQuaid, used to own the land. Patty says her uncle Bud planted these daffodils because Florence loved them so, and because he loved her so, through 60 years of marriage.
So every day was as happy as this day.
I would surmise so.
Mm-hmm. As testament.
Yes, yes.
Today, there are roughly 40,000 flowers.
That was his memory of her.
After Florence died, dividing the bulbs to grow more became Bud's annual tribute and obsession. He lived to 103, planting daffodils almost to the very end. Bud passed in 2019, and his property went on the market. It's a prime building lot, so many thought that would be the end of it.
You know, someone would build something on this, and this would become just someone's front lawn, and the flowers would be gone.
But neighbor Stacy Steinmetz stepped in, buying the property and the metaphor that comes with it.
I guess just like his love grew, the field continues to grow. You know, it's everlasting and it's expanding. So I certainly wouldn't want that to be lost.
So it stays, an eternal sign of spring and brilliantly illustrated love story, documenting in vivid color for couples everywhere.
It smells so good.
It does.
Just how endless love can be. Steve Hartman, on the road in Redding, Connecticut.
All right, partners, it's time to start splitting bulbs because your loved one heard this and is expecting something.
Right. 7:47, here's G. Scott from the Gian Ursula Show, which begins at 9. So I follow the news fairly closely. Even I was surprised when James told me, Dave, we had 6 mass shootings between Friday and yesterday. Not everybody died. That's a good thing. Of course, the biggest one was the massacre in Buffalo, New York. But I think most of us would be hard pressed to remember what the other 5 were. And that's just going to be the way it is, right? You haven't got the capacity to be concerned, outraged, upset, aggrieved when you have the sheer number of these things going on.
Yeah, and this isn't new. The only difference is there are more dangerous guns, if you will, more rounds, more capacity to be able to do damage even faster. Guns and problems with them has been this country has been known for. Mm-hmm. The only difference is that we have cell phones now. The only difference is we have media now. We have social media. We have digital media. We have more people talking about these topics. But these things used to happen all the time. I'm bringing that up to say it's nothing new in our way of dealing with it. And hearing this news now is we hear about it. It was over the weekend, and then Tuesday's going to come, and we're going to be talking about something else. There's going to be no gun laws are going to happen, nothing to kind of keep the guns. Everybody's going to make sure that their right to bear arms is still there. Mm-hmm. They're going to, you know, talk about the Second
Amendment. What would you change if you could?
I would really change gun laws to the point where the only people that are allowed to carry guns out and about are law enforcement. Mm-hmm. That's how extreme I would go with it. But again, I after Sandy Hook happened, and you guys are hearing my voice right now because you're hearing two things. You're hearing hurt, one, and then you're hearing, yeah, we're all hurt and we all know what's going on, but we're not going to do anything about it. And so there's a frustration, right? Because no matter what, we can sit here and talk about it. We're all out of thoughts and prayers because we're tired of saying that.
Yeah.
And bottom line is families have lost their loved ones. They're never coming back, and we just move on. And so there's just frustration that you hear out of me. I hope I didn't come on here to talk about this in a great way. But
I think you're right. Real politicians are paralyzed. Real gun control is never going to happen.
No.
I think what might happen, because I've sort of seen inklings of this, is that in a society where you cannot control guns, you're going to have to control people. And a lot of these people they're telling us what they're going to do. They're posting it. And I think at some point, I mean, I've talked about creating a no-buy list because this guy purchased his gun legally. He wasn't in the records. I think it has to be done on a casual basis. Social media is a powerful thing. And at some point, people get fed up enough that they will search the internet, find these people, start posting their names, and let society take care of it.
Can we start talking about young men's mental health too? Is that appropriate in this conversation yet to talk about the mind space of these extreme, racist, lost young men?
Yeah, it's not women.
Who, again, post their manifestos, tell us who they are, and we need to believe them. But how do we catch them before they do this? He wanted to be caught, presumably, if he posted it before he went and targeted and hunted down black people at a supermarket. So who's monitoring this? There was another shooting that was live streamed. You remember, it was a few years ago. A reporter was doing a live shot and a disgruntled employee.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched it happen live because that was the first time we had seen a live mass shooting. I remember on Twitter, I said, hey, Dave, I think this is the shooter. And I pressed play right as he held the gun up. And fortunately, I looked away before he shot her. That should have solved that issue right there. We should be monitoring the social media and mental health of these young men.
I think what's important is how it's being talked about. Because for so many years, media and how it's been talked about has been different. I'll give you an example. Tim McVeigh, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
The white nationalist who was a white nationalist for years. He was reprimanded by the army for attending a KKK meeting, right? During that time. Somebody's like, ooh, I didn't know that. I assure you didn't. But when they talked about the Oklahoma City bombing, it was reported, always talked about as an anti-government attack.
Right.
You see, when you cover news and you talk about news and you shape that narrative like that, and then later on when you have 9/11 and then all the Muslims in this country are deemed as someone, unfortunately, calling them terrorists and all those things. Let's talk about all the terrorist acts that's happening in this country.
Yeah, the white terrorists is what you're saying, right?
you know what I mean? Not the outliers, mm-hmm. The actual. So there is the way that it's being discussed. Tim McVeigh was called an anti-government attack. So what's different now? What's different now is media is doing a better job at calling it what it is and getting down to the nitty-gritty and of the details of it.
The FBI warned about domestic white supremacy years ago.
Yeah. And you know what upsets me is the New York Times, the first article I read this morning in the New York Times about the Buffalo shooting, was his name. The very first thing in the article was the shooter's name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That upset. That's where we're still getting it wrong, is we're giving these terrorists, these delusional, racist, extremely violent and dangerous individuals fame.
And then
you won't hear me say his name.
And then he was, and they did a good job. They arrested him without incident, mm-hmm. no problem or anything.
All right. G. Scott, 9 o'clock with Ursula. Thank you, G.
It's 8:15, Seattle's Morning News. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Dave Ross. Have you heard there's a baby formula shortage?
I have heard.
Yeah, this is bad. Congress still trying to figure out what to do about it. Grocery stores, now food banks, say their cupboards are bare, and mothers are still trying to explain why they can't just breastfeed on demand. It's a maddening equation to try and solve for parents of infants. So I wanted to share one other resource for families who are struggling. Breast milk donation banks.
When I was pregnant with my first, I just assumed. I was like, women have been having babies for millennia, and we have been nursing, and my body will just know what to do, and everything will be natural, and the baby will latch. And that wasn't the case at all.
Anna Eisenman, who I happen to know, we used to work together, has been on both sides of the struggle with her first son.
I had a nearly impossible time nursing my first. I was very low supply. He had teeth at 3 months and was a biter. It just, like, the deck was stacked against us.
So consider her pleasantly surprised when, with her second son,
when Arthur came along, and all of a sudden I realized that I was producing this ridiculous excess. I mean, first, I think I high-fived my husband. And I still, every time I pump, I'm just amazed at what my body is doing this time.
What counts as an oversupply?
I realized that we were, just how much I was producing when I started filling up the door of our deep freeze. And after the first 6 weeks, I had filled up, it's like a five shelf door, and I had filled up the first two shelves and was still nursing Arthur fine without a problem.
Except what to do with all that frozen breast milk. She did some research and found the Rocky Mountain Children's Health Foundation in Colorado, which helps run 32 nonprofit breast milk banks across the U.S. The group gets donated breast milk here through Tacoma General Hospital. So Anna did a phone screen, a blood test, and the milk bank spoke with her OBGYN, who confirmed her second son, Arthur, is in fact thriving and the oversupply was the real deal. So without further ado, get a load of these numbers.
They called me about a week later to say that everything had been processed and donated. And I think it was 720 ounces that I had donated, a little over 5.5 gallons.
Does that paint a picture in your, I'm not sure how this translates for people who have never lactated, but 720 ounces, you know how long that takes to build up? How much time Anna spent pumping this and lovingly, sanitarily placing it in a bag and freezing it? She should have a bronze statue in her honor. 5.5 gallons of donated breast milk. Usually this donated milk is a lifeline for premature babies and families who need to what's called a bridge milk when the mother supply doesn't come in soon enough to begin feeding her newborn. So that's typically where this milk goes. Jody Whitesell is with the Rocky Mountain Group.
One of the biggest things that I wish could be dispelled is the idea that formula is the only option if parents aren't able to breastfeed for one reason or another. Breast milk has so many incredible nutritional benefits. It has a lot of bioactive properties. It's full of so many wonderful things that can help babies, whether they're premature or they're at home and healthy and thriving.
And here's where I need to say this, because, you know, I'm suggesting that if you can't find formula, you can use donated breast milk. What I'm not trying to do with this story is shame anybody about what they're using to feed their baby, whether it's breast milk from yourself, from a donator, from a donor, or from formula. Feeding babies is a very loaded topic for mothers. The whole breast is best movement only heaped guilt and shame when, for reasons out of mother's control, the milk isn't coming in, or it's not enough, or medically they can't, or adopt it, or there are plenty of reasons. What I'm trying to do is share another resource for those looking for formula that you can buy. Donated breast milk.
Part of what I love so much about donor milk is it really does help facilitate a really successful lactation journey. So obviously it helps feed the baby in the short term, but part of the beauty of using it is for families who might be struggling with getting their milk going, or for one reason or another having issues breastfeeding. it gives them some way to kind of jumpstart that process a little bit. So it's really a tool that people can use.
And when it comes to feeding babies, take it from a former lactating woman, me, you need all the support, all the tools and options available. Anna, our super donor, agrees.
And they told me, your baby isn't getting enough to eat. He's losing weight. He's dehydrated. We're going to give him some formula. And the whole time during my pregnancy, I was like, I don't care if I have a C-section. I don't care about drugs. I don't care about anything, you know, as long as I can nurse my baby. And I had put so much pressure on myself of being able to do this for him that when they gave him a bottle of formula and he chugged it and I saw, you know, just how hungry he was, it was, I sobbed. It was heartbreaking. I felt like I had failed my child. And then the more that I talked about this struggle with other moms and other women, everybody has those hurdles. I mean, nobody has an easy time breastfeeding. It's just something that no one talks about.
So my hope is the overall message here is there is help out there for you, whether you're struggling to feed your baby or struggling to find formula. Maybe consider purchasing donated breast milk, because the Rocky Mountain Children's Health Foundation is there with the resources. They also have groups to help support you. Anna has been where you are, struggling to feed her child, and now she's there to help.
It felt empowering. You know, I felt strong. I want to tell everybody about it. It's such an incredible program. And there are so many women who, you know, either have excess or need just a little bit more that can reach out to these banks. It's still hard to wrap my head around sometimes. You know, I'll be bagging everything up and freezing it at the end of the day, and it's just gives me this warm glow.
Again, the name of the group, Rocky Mountain Children's Health Foundation. They can ship overnight too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they are well equipped, if you cannot find formula, to send you tested, fresh breast milk.
I didn't even realize it existed.
Yeah.
And I've witnessed, let's see, three women struggle with breastfeeding very close to me. And so that's great. And also, the other thing is that in my experience with those three women, sometimes even a woman who thinks it's hopeless finds within a few months that suddenly she's also got this tremendous oversupply. So, I mean, it can turn around. You can always have.
You have to stick with it if you have the time and the resources and the support group. It can be a really, really awful shame spiral when it's happening to you. But if you keep at it, it can be yours. But, you know, what these groups are out for, what formula is for, is to say, hey, take a deep breath.
Yep.
Here's some formula. Here's some donated breast milk.
I mean, that's the other thing people wonder. Is it safe to do?
But absolutely. Like I said,
so they test everything.
They screened Anna to make sure, you know, she's fit, that, you know, what medications are you taking? Because there's certain medications that you cannot take and, you know, pump and donate. So you got to take those off the list. They speak to your OBGYN, and then they also do a blood screen. So all of it is safe. Good. Use.
Reassuring.
Yes. Rocky Mountain Children's Health Foundation. I'll also put this story up on mynorthwest.com. And if you want to see the picture, I shared the picture with you of all her donated milk day.
Oh.
Look at that refrigerator.
Yeah, I know. So what is that? It looks like a library card file, but no, that's actually a filed breast milk.
Yeah, that's breast milk. So I put that on my Twitter too, if you just want to see how amazing Anna is. So thanks, Anna. I know you're listening. Thanks for sharing your story.
Seattle's Morning News, 8:35. Tonight, Seattle Opera and the Pacific Northwest Ballet Orchestra hold a benefit concert for artists who have had to flee Ukraine because of the Russian invasion. KIRE News Radio's Heather Bosch has the story.
The Ukrainian national anthem will fill Macaw Hall, followed by a variety of music.
I think it's so beautiful concert. So different music, different pieces from different. It will be from ballet, it's folk music, classical music.
Mezzo-soprano Olga Sinyakova is in Seattle performing The Marriage of Figaro. At the benefit concert, the Ukrainian native will sing selections from Strauss, which she declined to sing to me unaccompanied.
Oh, it's difficult to sing Strauss without that.
But she did treat me to a little Saint-Saëns.
This aria, Mon Coeur, if you know. Mon Coeur s'ouvre ta voix comme s'ouvre. It's very famous,
it's
this one.
Beautiful. Does it have a personal meaning?
Really, this aria that changed my life to be an international singer.
Now, the aria that put her on the world stage takes new significance as she performs it in a concert to benefit artists in Ukraine, even as she worries about her own parents still there.
I'm scared because in the night, a lot of times, they have this siren.
Air raid sirens that sent her parents and other Ukrainians scrambling into shelters as bombs and guns ravage the country.
I'm still nervous. I'm still thinking all time. It's going, it's like nonstop. I'm thinking about parents and what happens in Ukraine.
Already performing internationally when Russia invaded, she says the war at first left her petrified.
But I was like frozen 1 week without any emotion because I was thinking, how could I help? Being singer, how could I help my country?
She says it was during a performance of Verdi's Requiem that she was reminded of what so many artists innately know.
And there I felt the power and meaning of art, of singing, of the beauty.
It's why Ukrainian fighters holed up defiantly inside a steel mill are heard singing patriotic songs, and why a group of soldiers stand reverently as one picks up a violin and plays the national anthem. It's why Olga wants to make sure Ukrainian artists can continue to bring their messages to the world as musicians here in Seattle send out their own.
The main message that I would like to send to them that it's love. It's first of all, it's to love each other.
Heather Bosch, Cairo News Radio.
And Heather joins us live.
Hey.
What a story. We saw Marriage of Figaro over the week. She plays Cherubino?
I'd have to look up the specific part. I've been so worried about getting the Strauss not confused with the Sanson and finding the right. That is her singing, by the way, yeah. Not only in the interview, but afterwards I found a concert of her online. So amazing singer and huge heart.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what to say. What do you do when you're half a world away watching these things happen to your country for no reason that anybody can discern and then having to go on? I'll tell you, the audience loved that performance.
Yeah.
They're on their feet right away.
Yeah.
So.
She, in fact, some of her colleagues were afraid to talk to her about the war because they knew how she was really struggling to stay focused. And she does a wonderful job doing that. But she's, you know, she finally had someone go out for a walk with her and said, hey, it's okay to talk about it. And she's getting together with the many Ukrainian people in our community as well, which helps. But as you said, Dave, I mean, sometimes I think it's tougher for people just on the outside, just on that periphery who can't be there to help.
Well, usually when this happens, people get busy, right? And she's an artist and she's going to use her art to raise money. And a little girl I know whose family comes from Kazakhstan but has family in Ukraine and Russia, you know, she opened up her piggy bank and was going to donate it to the effort. So I think that's what you do when you're a half world away. You do everything you can.
So the concert's tonight. Are there tickets available still?
You'll have to look because they were selling fast last time I looked. But it's 7:30 tonight, McCall Hall, one night only.
Heather Bosch. Thank you, Heather. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.